Aquilan Real 2. So did you have any idea what commandos were or what they were going to be doing?
Well, we knew. Yeah, I knew before I volunteered, but I was just concerned. I wasn't really concerned with what was going to happen. All I wanted to do was get on with doing something that was better than putting practice bombs on Whitleys. And we did that. We went off on 25-mile route marches and a lot of cross-country running and... And we had one commanding officer, one adjutant, one armament officer, and one engineering officer, and a dozen or so sergeants and flight sergeants and warrant officers with us. But they'd all volunteered for this anyway, and they were all on the same thing.
So it was very much a new thing, was it?
It was fairly new, yeah. This was 43. The first ones had probably been formed in 42 or possibly a bit earlier to do the North African thing.
Yeah. So they were getting you fit and they were teaching you what more sort of army style?
Arm defence and rifle firing and attack, and I think we had a couple of Bren guns.
Right.
Yeah, we did. All our own transport, including a couple of jeeps and a couple of dispatch riders, motorcyclists for dispatch riders. And at the end of August at Zeals, we drove in convoy to the Combined Operations Centre at Inverary for a 2-week combined operations course.
So what was that like then?
Which
the
journey took about 3 days.
Yeah.
Because we stopped at a couple of staging camps or 3 staging camps.
Yeah.
And then drove up to... And that was a lot of the work was on board these landing ships and climbing down scramble nets into smaller boats and smaller boats zipping about Loch Fyne and people throwing thunder flashes at us and firing blank ammunition above our heads and all this.
So you were doing schemes then?
Yeah.
Right.
And
how did you cope with all that?
Oh, okay, because we were so fit. It didn't bother us really.
Yeah. What sort of a place was Inverary?
Oh, it's a nice place, and it's hardly changed. I've been back since, and the town itself has hardly changed at all. And we lived in under canvas just down the road from the town. There were a lot of other people there because it was one of the centres for this combined operations thing, which was the army people and the Royal Marine Commandos and all sorts of people doing the same things that we'd done. At the end of the 2 weeks, we got our combined operations badges.
You were quite proud of those,
I think. Yeah. And drove back to, as a unit, drove back to Hawkinge, in RAF Hawkinge in Kent.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. And did you know what they were training you up for?
Well, we knew we were being trained up to do something, but we didn't really know anything other than that. And this was... September 43. Well, what happened? We got back to Hawkinge, and a couple of weeks at Hawkinge, not really doing any work. Each flight from the unit was then posted to a different RAF station. So that, and what we did, we just helped whoever was at this RAF station with their work. In our case, we went to Friston near Eastbourne.
Friston?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where there was a squadron, a Belgian squadron of Spitfires.
Oh, right.
And we helped them out with their work on these Spitfires and duty crew. And it was... a convenient landing place for any bombers that had been lost an engine or two on bombing raids to sort of get back to England and land.
Yeah.
There was that sort of thing happened as well.
Did it? Yeah. So you got them limping in.
Yeah, they limped in and all that sort of stuff. And then we...
Sorry, can I just ask you, what were the Belgians like?
Oh, they were fine. They were fine. We got on very well with them.
Did they behave differently to the British flight crews?
No, not really. Yeah. Not really, because they've been going for a while. You got a complete squadron of Spitfires there,
yeah.
And they were all Belgian pilots.
Yeah.
A lot of the air crews were English. A lot of the ground crews were English anyway. But there were one or two Belgian ground crews.
Did they have families still in Belgium, do you think?
A lot of them did, yeah.
Did they talk about what was happening?
Yeah, because, well, they didn't really know. They just thought, well, we don't know. I mean, I can remember them saying, we might never see our families again. We don't know what's happened to them. But they were just happy to get away and try and sort the thing out from this side.
Yeah, yeah. So that's you were helping the...
So we helped them out... until April 1944.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When we all went back to RAF Hawkinge, mm-hmm. and came together as a squad, as a unit again.
Right.
In May 1944, we went down to a field outside Bognor Regis. With nothing to do. Because this was a big build-up.
Yes. Did you have an idea that this was the same?
Well, we had an idea this was a big build-up because on the route down, on the route across country from Hawkins to Bognor, we'd seen fields of completely full of lorries and tanks with nobody there. But we thought, well, anyway, something was going to happen. We stayed at Bognor Regis until the end of May. Mm-hmm. And then we just went to Old Sarum, one of the camps on Salisbury Plain, of which there were so many, where the lorries were waterproof because they had to be waterproof to drive underwater, as it were.
Yeah. What was your unit called now?
Called 3210 Servicing Commando,
right.
RAF.
Yeah. Did you have any reservations about going into action?
Nope.
Pleased to go, were you?
I think most of us were, from what I can remember. Because we were all volunteers, so, I mean, you probably had sort of, well, you know, what's going to happen, but that sort of thing, but... You'd all volunteered and you knew what you were getting into.
Yeah. What did your parents think about your service?
Well, I remember writing to my father at his business address saying, you better break the news because I'm not going to write home.
You didn't want to tell your mum?
Well, I didn't. And he did, and he wrote back to me and said, OK, that's all right, you just get on with it, he said.
Yeah.
But she probably wasn't very happy because we didn't have any leave before we went to Normandy.
Did you not? Yeah.
Not before we went,
yeah.
No.
At what stage did you know when you were going, you know?
What, the only clue we got we were going to go to Normandy was... After we'd left Old Sarum, after the lorries were waterproof, which didn't take that 2 or 3 days, on June the 5th, we left Old Sarum for Fareham, which was just purely and simply a transit camp. Got there in the evening of the 5th, and the first thing we had to do was go through to the orderly room and get some French francs.
I gave you a bit too then.
And they were these new French francs that had been printed in England with a red, white and blue flag on the back. And then the next thing they said, Reveille will be 2:30 in the morning. So everybody said, well, there's not much point in going to bed again or going to bed at all. And we sort of sat around talking and had something to eat and a cup of tea. And that was my 21st birthday. The following morning, on the 6th, at 3 o'clock, we were en route in our lorries down from Fareham to Gosport.
Uh-huh. Did you see a lot of other stuff going the same way? Was it all?
Yeah, the road seemed to be completely full. I mean, once we got down to Gosport, we realised why, because you could hardly see the sea for the landing craft on it.
Quite exciting.
Oh, it was. We got on board just as.
What sort of landing craft did you go on?
It was called a landing craft tank, but we didn't have any tanks on it. We had our lorries on it.
Right.
Or four lorries on it. It was sea fleet. Each flight, as far as I know, each flight had its own landing craft. Mm.
Mm. Which flight were you?
I was C.
Got onto the landing craft. And
we got on about 9 o'clock in the morning, which was, and we heard Eisenhower's broadcast. So we on the morning of the 6th, so we knew then what was on. But the sea was so full of ships that it was sort of you were like in a queue,
yeah.
And we left Gosport about at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was, because it was a flat bottom, the sea wasn't that rough on the 6, it was choppy, but it a flat bottom, and a lot of us, including me, were seasick,
yeah.
Really seasick. We were off the French coast at 4:30 in the morning.
Really?
Just in a queue.
Could you see there?
Well, all these ships in front of us, a bit of the, it was a little bit too far away, unless you got glasses to see what was going on the beach. You could see, as far as you could see, it was quiet. The lorries were going off, and the odd tank was still going off and then disappearing.
So this would be the 4:30 a.m. on the...
This was at 4:30 on the 7th.
Yeah.
And we landed at about 9:30.
Uh-huh. And what did you see as you landed? How organised
was it? Where we landed, it was reasonably well organised.
Whereabouts did you land?
It was placed near Gray-sur-Mer, which is G-R-A-Y-E... hyphen S-U-R hyphen capital M-E-R.
Yeah. So there was no opposition?
No, there wasn't any opposition. We could hear the gun firing going on, which wasn't that far away, but there wasn't any actual opposition on that beach on June the 7th. We had four plus a jeep.
Right, and who was in charge?
The flying officer, armament officer.
Uh-huh. Do you remember him?
Flying officer Hannaford.
Uh-huh. What sort of a chap was he?
Very sort of typical. It's all. I was going to say typical aircrew, but of course he wasn't aircrew. He always used to wear a silk scarf knotted round his neck, and he's flat out on at an angle. We drove up this road where there was an MP, and he said, "Who are you?" And we told him, and he said, "Well, you're not on my list." He said, "You just go down the road," and we went down the road, and we thought, "Well, it's a bit," and we turned off into a field, and waited for the rest of the unit who didn't appear. And we, well, spent the night in the field. The lorries, parked the lorries sort of a fair way from each other, around the edge of the field, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. A sniper popped his head up from the farmhouse at 3 o'clock in the morning and started firing off bullets at the lorries.
Really?
But he didn't hit anything or anybody. And nothing else happened, and it was only for a short while. And we decided to wait and see if it happened again. If it had happened again, somebody would had to have gone down and try to find him. But first thing in the morning, the armament officer went off to look for the rest of the unit and came back after 2 hours and said, "It's all right, I found them." What had happened, as happened in a lot of cases, with so much sea traffic, we landed at a little different part, a small way away from them. But it was far enough that we went up one road, they went up another one. And they thought we'd had it. We thought they'd had it. But we drove to where we were supposed to go, which was an airstrip, not that very far, advanced landing ground, they call them.
What sort of airstrip was that?
Well, it was basically was an airstrip called B3. All the airstrips in the British sector were called B something. The Americans were called A something. Not very far off the coast, not far from Bayeux, at a village. The nearest village was Saint-Croix-sur-Mer.
Oh, right.
And basically all that was a flat piece of land which had got wheat on it. And that had been bulldozed off by an Army Air Construction Corps. And the first... We went in there and we had to go and find some food for a start.
how much rations did you carry with you?
We didn't carry a lot with us. We took something onto the boat and ate on the boat and made some tea, and we didn't actually have any more. We had enough to carry on with that night when we were in the field by ourselves. We got to the airstrip. We ran back to one of the beaches and picked up some compo rations. And got back to the airstrip and went back again to pick up some jerry cans full of petrol. Yeah. That was for the aircraft that were going to come in. And the first aircraft landed on June the 9th at B3. And we refueled these Spitfires who'd come out from England. They went off and did a recce or a sortie over the battlefield and came back to us. They were refueled, and if they'd fired their guns, they were rearmed.
Right. What did you get a sense of what was going on?
Well,
where the fighting was?
This is quite interesting, because having been back several times and having recently been back with a crowd of people, none of whom had been there, only me, and were ex-service, and you knew what was going on in your own little bit, which, as far as we were concerned, was an advanced landing ground. You didn't know what was going on up the road. You just... the discovery of what various other people were doing in other times I've been back has been quite interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, we had we were bombed and we were shelled and there was the odd escape, and but we got on. We were very busy. We were refueling and rearming, and initially we were having to go off once we'd done that and pick up food and pick up petrol and in cans and pick up ammunition and everything for a week or but. After we were picking it up from a beach, and it wasn't Arromanche because we didn't know about Mulberry Harbour until about 2 months afterwards because we'd never seen it. We moved from there on the 15th of June and went to another airstrip called Beni-sur-Mer. Beny, Sir Mayor. And we carried on doing what we'd done at St. Croix. The reason they moved us was from St. Croix is they moved in some ground staff to St. Croix, so we could move on a bit farther up. And this happened to us. We moved from Beny-sur-Mer to a place called St. Gabriel. To another, from St. Gabriel to an airstrip called Martragny, Martragney.
And were your duties always the same?
We always did the same sort of thing with Spitfires, Typhoons, Hurricanes, Mustangs. The old American Thunderbolt, which had landed, and in one case we had a Halifax land at an airstrip, which was completely unusual. It needed a lot of petrol. I don't know why, I can't remember why, but he said he was low in petrol. And could we put some in? And this was, we were still then refueling with 5 gallon drums of petrol. Because we formed a chain to take the cans round to the wings of the Spitfires, which was relatively easy. But with the Halifax, the gates had to get up in the air with them. We put 800 gallons in out of five gallon tins.
That's a lot of tins.
And the CO said to him, "I hope you don't come back again." But later on, we got. When Pluto came in, which was a pipeline, Bowsers went down and the first Bowser that came onto an airstrip, it was a fantastic sign.
The answer to your prayers.
The answer to our prayers, and I often wonder what happened to all the empty jerry cans. Because, well, it must have been sad, because everybody had to use. I can remember taking some back, but, I mean, sometimes there was the guy, "Oh, don't bring any more back. We got nowhere to put them."
So the sort of everyday housekeeping things are very important, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Keep the whole effort going.
Yeah. We did this all these strips, all the same thing.
How busy were you? What sort of length of days were you working? Getting any rest time?
Well, they came in June. They came over, they used to appear sort of, not quite first light, but they'd appear about 7 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes they'd land, depending whereabouts they come across from England, sometimes they wouldn't land when they came in because they didn't really use a lot of fuel. Sometimes they would. And they used to go on. They used to do sortie around the battlefield and come back and land and be refueled and rearmed. Probably if they crossed the French coast about 7, they'd be back with us by 8. And they go off and they do another hour or so. And they come back and they wouldn't go back initially until sort of it was getting dusk.
Really?
And then the first 2-3 weeks we used to have to go back to the beach and fetch stuff for next day.
So you were working?
We were working long hours. We were, if we went to bed, we went to, slept in foxholes covered with tents. And you sort of didn't take your boots off or things like that.
So it was tough.
It was tough, but we managed to get on with it. And it did get a bit easier as the third or fourth airstrip, because, A, there were so many aircraft doing it, and there were so many other units in there, and there was so much ground staff in there. And we got one of the squadrons that came in, we got them to fly in some beer in their spare. They used to carry Spitfires and Hurricanes, could carry tanks under the wings, which gave them extra petrol. Yeah. And we got them to bring in some of these with beer on. Which was perfectly all right, except for two planes, I think. They came in, took the tanks off, gave us to them, and somebody opened them up, and they'd been used for petrol before. So some of them were okay and some of them weren't, but it was, and they brought newspapers and white, we got them to bring white bread in as well if they could manage it. But I spent some time up in the American sector on A1, which was a place called Saint-Pierre-du-Monde.
Just while you... did you get a sense of how many aircraft were being lost? You know, the Spitfires and so on,
They weren't really... I can't remember, I don't know what the official figures are, but there weren't very many lost of Spitfires and Hurricanes. There were a lot of typhoons. That's the other thing I've forgotten to mention. Initially, they thought they would be in and out of Caen within the first couple of days, but they weren't, and it was there for quite a while. And a lot of typhoons went in on low-level rockets.
Ones that you are...
Four rockets under each wing. Mm. And the way they went in... And there were 200 typhoon pilots... Approximately 200 typhoon pilots engaged in the Normandy campaign. And there were 151 of them were shot down and killed. The reason I know that is because I saw the memorial last week in Normandy. It's the first time I'd seen it. I knew it was there, but it was the first time I'd seen it.
So you must have known a lot of those, or by sight anyway.
Yeah. A lot of Canadian squadrons were typhoons, as well as English and Australians.
What were the Canadians like?
The Canadian typhoon pilots were okay, they were fine. I mean, that was a pretty tough thing because of the way they had to do it. The rockets, and they had four rockets under each wing and two machine guns, I think. Well, they might have been cannons on top of them, but it was low level stuff. They were some, apart from the Caen thing, they were the ones that shot up convoys on the road, a German yes. convoys on the road as well. And the French put this monument up. It's not been there very long because it's only sort of somehow came to the French that so many typhoon pilots had died.
Yeah. So you were refueling them?
We were refueling and putting rockets on. And
did you get a sense of... They must have felt they were a bit branded, really, you know, to be in an unlucky aircraft to fly, really, an unlucky job.
Well, I can't remember any of them sort of saying, I mean, they must have thought themselves, they must have thought it was a pretty dicey business, but I think aircrew obviously had got, most of the aircrew became hardened to this thing. They must have done. We at one strip we put, which was Benny Samer, we actually put rockets on and we could walk up to the end of the strip and see the typhoons firing them off at Caen.
I'll stop you just then. A.W. McQuillan, end of reel 2.